March 7th, 1965. The American Dream and the American Negro by James Baldwin. The Southern oligarchy, which has still today so very much power in Washington, was created by my labor and my sweat and the violation of my women and the murder of my children. None can challenge that statement. It is a matter of historical record.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. First gay imam assassinated in South Africa, violent New Zealand Christians attack drag king Storytime, and the Baldwin of yesterday speaks to Black lives today. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm Melanie Keller.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 22nd, 2025. The world's first out gay imam is dead, killed in broad daylight on the streets of the South African city of Ngabira. The car Mussin Hendricks was riding in was blocked off by a pickup truck, as seen on closed circuit video. Two hooded figures emerged from the truck and opened fire into the back seat where Hendricks was sitting. His driver was uninjured. Eastern Cape police say the motive is unknown and the investigation is ongoing. To South Africa's second biggest political party, the nature of the killing strongly suggests a professional hit, as a Democratic Alliance representative told the CBC. The 57-year-old Hendricks came out as gay in 1996. He held his first meetings in his home, then in a mosque he established where all Muslims could pray without judgment. The February 15th murder sent shockwaves throughout the queer Muslim community and local and global equality advocacy groups. The International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association called on local authorities to thoroughly investigate what we fear may be a hate crime. ILGA, World Executive Director Julia Ert, called Hendricks' life a testament to the healing that solidarity across communities can bring in everyone's lives. The Muslim Judicial Council and the United Ulama Council of South Africa condemned the killing. Both leading South African Muslim organizations consistently criticized Hendricks' efforts at reconciliation. Both maintain the traditional view of Islam that the Quran prohibits romantic same-gender relationships. His high-profile advocacy made Hendricks the frequent target of death threats. In the 2022 documentary, The Radical, he said about his coming out, "The need to be authentic was greater than the fear to die." Mussin Hendricks' funeral was reportedly held in Cape Town.
About 30 young children and adults are traumatized after the invasion into an Auckland, New Zealand drag king story time by some 50 far-right Christians. Hugo Girl's February 15th event was part of the city's annual LGBTQ Pride celebration. The disruptive protesters affiliated with the fundamentalist Destiny Church punched, pushed, and shoved their way inside the building, according to local media accounts. When they refused to leave, the event organizers were eventually forced to cancel. Auckland Police Inspector Simon Walker thinks the protesters crossed the line. In his words, the group's actions caused considerable distress and concern among children, library staff, and visitors. Nobody, especially children, should ever be made to feel unsafe. Walker says that the investigation is in the early stages. Several hours after the library attack, Destiny Church members broke through barricades and tried to block the Auckland Rainbow Parade. Police forced them to disperse without any physical confrontations. No arrests have been announced.
Judge Anna Reyes says the claim that trans pronoun use undermines troop effectiveness is frankly ridiculous. She heard arguments on February 18th in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia challenging President Donald Trump's executive order to ban military service by qualified transgender enlistees. Reyes found some of the government's arguments biologically inaccurate and called them simply evidence of unadulterated animus towards trans people. The lesbian jurist demanded, "Can we agree that the greatest fighting force that world history has ever seen is not going to be impacted in any way by less than 1% of the soldiers using a different pronoun than others might want to call them?" Reyes is clearly expected to rule for the plaintiffs. Jennifer Levi is Senior Director of Transgender and Queer Rights for GLBTQ Legal Advocates and Defenders, or GLAAD Law. Her group has joined with the National Center for Lesbian Rights to represent the plaintiffs. Levi told the Washington Blade, "The government cannot justify discharging transgender troops who have honorably served our country for years." Judge Reyes still must officially decide whether to issue a temporary restraining order blocking implementation of Trump's January 27th anti-trans order. Earlier this month, another group of transgender service members filed a separate challenge to the ban on Fifth and First Amendment grounds in a federal court in Washington state. They're represented by attorneys from Lambda Legal and the Human Rights Campaign.
Kansas Democratic Governor Laura Kelly tried again, but the third time the overwhelming Republican majority in the state legislature overrode her veto of a measure outlawing pediatric gender-affirming health care. It's one of the nation's harshest trans health care bans. Providers can be stripped of their medical licenses for unprofessional conduct, or sued by individuals for treating young trans patients. Even the use of state funds to provide psychological support for transgender youth is prohibited. Virtually every professional medical and mental health organization in the U.S. endorses pediatric gender-affirming healthcare. Experts agree that for some patients, it can literally be life-saving. Kansas joins more than half of the states in the country to enact some form of restriction or ban on gender-affirming health care for trans young people. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in a case challenging Tennessee's ban late last year. It's expected to announce a ruling before the end of its current term this June.
Other Democratic governors are on the front lines battling the federal anti-LGBTQ plus onslaught. Trump called out Maine Governor Janet Mills over her state's policy in favor of transgender student athletes at a February 21st White House meeting.
Is Maine here, the governor of Maine?
Yeah, I'm here.
Are you not going to comply with it?
I'm complying with state and federal laws.
We are the federal law. Mm-hmm. So you better comply, because otherwise you're not getting any federal funding.
See you in court.
Governor Janet Mills says she won't be intimidated by Trump's threats or by an investigation into Maine's policies by the Department of Education. Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker skewered the Trump administration during his annual State of the State address on February 19th, reaffirming his state's safe haven for LGBTQ plus people. Pritzker echoed the stark warnings of Lutheran pastor Martin Niemöller about Adolf Hitler's rise to power, one ostracized group at a time.
The authoritarian playbook is laid bare here. They point to a group of people who don't look like you and tell you to blame them for your problems. I just have one question. What comes next? After we've discriminated against, deported, or disparaged all the immigrants and the gay and lesbian and transgender people, the developmentally disabled, the women, and the minorities, once we've ostracized our neighbors and betrayed our friends, after that, when the problems we started with are still there staring us in the face, what comes next? All the atrocities of human history lurk in the answer to that question. And if we don't want to repeat history, then for God's sake, in this moment, we'd better be strong enough to learn from it.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker.
Finally, questions abound about how much art will survive at Washington, D.C.'s John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. The former star of The Apprentice has said, "You're fired," to the Progressive Board of Trustees and installed himself as chair at the home of the annual Kennedy Center Honors. Just before what's seen as a hostile takeover, the center announced the cancellation of A Peacock Among Pigeons, celebrating 50 years of pride. The special World Pride performance, starring the city's Gay Men's Chorus with the National Symphony Orchestra, had been scheduled for May 21st. NSO Executive Director Gene Davidson blamed the postponement on financial and scheduling factors. The center will produce a pride-honoring performance of The Wizard of Oz to take its place. The chorus will now perform A Peacock Among Pigeons during World Pride's International Choral Festival. A statement from the Gay Men's Chorus called the decision deeply disappointing. The group vows to advocate for artistic expression that reflects the depth and diversity of our community and country. We will continue to sing and raise our voices for equality. Meanwhile, artists have already launched protest actions around the Kennedy Center.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 22nd, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay healthy.
And I'm Melanie Keller. Stay safe. Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Bridges Lord, take my hand and lead me on.
Sixty years ago this month, Black gay author, activist, and public intellectual James Baldwin was invited to be a guest of the Cambridge Union, the University of Cambridge's historic debate and free speech society. None of the Southern segregationist politicians they asked would agree to appear with Baldwin. So the student organizers booked conservative founder of the National Review, William F. Buckley Jr., for the verbal face-off. Baldwin was widely credited with winning the February 18, 1965 debate.
Thank you.
3 days later, Malcolm X was assassinated. Baldwin returned to the U.S. for the Selma, Alabama Voting Rights March, and the New York Times published Buckley's remarks from Cambridge and the version of Baldwin's words you'll hear read today on March 7th. The very day Alabama state troopers beat the marchers trying to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Now our goal is Montgomery.
This is an unlawful assembly. You are to disperse. You are ordered to disperse.
In a June 1965 debate rematch on David Susskind's TV talk show Open End, Baldwin succumbed to Buckley's shock and awe verbiage. Years later, he's reported to have said, "To my eternal dishonor, I cooled it. I drew back and I lost the debate. I should have beat him over the head with the coffee cup."
George Floyd!
What's his name?
George Floyd!
What's his name?
George Floyd!
Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter!
I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
In June of 2020, the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officers had redoubled the Black Lives Matter movement and brought millions of protesters into the streets around the world. Meanwhile, This Way Out's Brian DeShazer was producing an online Pride Month global queer read-in. Los Angeles-based multidisciplinary performing artist Paul Outlaw resonated with how Baldwin addressed Cambridge's 1965 debate topic, "The American Dream is at the expense of the American Negro." With the possible exception of the word Negro, Baldwin's speech about black lives under white supremacy could hardly be more current. Here is Paul Outlaw.
March 7th, 1965. The American Dream and the American Negro by James Baldwin. I find myself not for the first time in the position of a kind of Jeremiah. It would seem to me that the question before the House is a proposition horribly loaded, that one's response to that question depends on where you find yourself in the world, what your sense of reality is. That is, it depends on assumptions we hold so deeply as to be scarcely aware of them. The white South African, or Mississippi sharecropper, or Alabama sheriff, has at bottom a system of reality which compels them really to believe when they face the Negro that this woman, this man, this child must be insane to attack the system to which he owes his entire identity. We speak about expense. There are several ways of addressing oneself to some attempt to find out what that word means here. From a very literal point of view, the harbors and the ports and the railroads of the country, the economy, especially in the South, could not conceivably be what they are if it had not been, and this is still so, for cheap labor. I am speaking very seriously, and this is not an overstatement. I picked cotton. I carried it to the market. I built the railroad under someone else's whip for nothing. For nothing. The Southern oligarchy, which has still today so very much power in Washington, and therefore some power in the world, was created by my labor and my sweat and the violation of my women and the murder of my children. This in the land of the free, the home of the brave. None can challenge that statement. It is a matter of historical record. In the Deep South, you are dealing with a sheriff or a landlord or a landlady or a girl at the Western Union desk. She doesn't know quite whom she is dealing with, by which I mean, if you are not part of a town, and if you are a northern neighbor, it shows in a million ways. She simply knows that it is an unknown quantity, and she wants nothing to have to do with it. You have to wait a while to get your telegram. We've all been through it. By the time you get to be a man, it is fairly easy to deal with. But what happens to the poor white man's, the poor white woman's mind? It is this. They have been raised to believe, and by now they helplessly believe, that no matter how terrible some of their lives may be, and no matter what disaster overtakes them, there is one consolation. Heavenly revelation. At least they are not black. I suggest that of all the terrible things that could happen to a human being, that is one of the worst. I suggest that what has happened to the white Southerner is in some ways much worse than what has happened to the Negroes there. Sheriff Clark in Selma, Alabama, cannot be dismissed as a total monster. I am sure he loves his wife and children and likes to get drunk. One has to assume he is a man like me. But he does not know what drives him to use the club, to menace with the gun and use the cattle prod. Something awful must have happened to a human being to be able to put a cattle prod against a woman's breasts. What happens to the woman is ghastly. What happens to the man who does it is in some ways much, much worse. Their moral lives have been destroyed by the plague called color. This is not being done 100 years ago, but in 1965, and in a country which is pleased with what we call prosperity, with a certain amount of social coherence, which calls itself a civilized nation and which espouses the notion of freedom in the world. If it were white people being murdered, the government would find some way of doing something about it. We have a civil rights bill now. We had the 15th Amendment nearly 100 years ago. If it was not honored then, I have no reason to be believing that the Civil Rights Bill will be honored now. The American soil is full of corpses of my ancestors through 400 years and at least three wars. Why is my freedom, my citizenship, in question now? What one begs American people to do for all sakes is simply to accept our history. It seems to me, when I watch Americans in Europe, that what they don't know about Europeans is what they don't know about me. They're not trying to be nasty to the French girl or rude to the French waiter. They did not know that they hurt their feelings. They didn't have any sense that this particular man and this particular woman were human beings. They walked over them with the same sort of bland ignorance and condescension, the charm and cheerfulness with which they had patted me on the head and which made them upset when I was upset. When I was brought up, I was taught in American history books that Africa had no history, and that neither had I. I was a savage about whom the least said the better, who had been saved by Europe and who had been brought to America. Of course, I believed it. I didn't have much choice. These were the only books there were. Everyone else seemed to agree. If you went out of Harlem, the whole world agreed. What you saw was much bigger, whiter, cleaner, safer. The garbage was collected, the children were happy. You could go back home, and it would seem, of course, that this was an act of God. You belonged where white people put you. It's only since World War II that there has been a counter image in the world. That image has not come about because of any legislation by any American government, but because Africa was suddenly on the stage of the world, and Africans had to be dealt with in a way they had never been dealt with before. This gave the American Negro, for the first time, a sense of himself not as a savage. It has created and will create a great many conundrums. One of the things the white world does not know, but I think I know, is that black people are just like everybody else. We are also mercenaries, dictators, murderers, liars. We are human too. Unless we can establish some kind of dialogue between those people who enjoy the American dream and those people who have not achieved it, we will be in terrible trouble. This is what concerns me most. We are sitting in this room and we are all civilized. We can talk to each other, at least on certain levels, so that we can walk out of here assuming that the measure of our politeness has some effect on the world. I remember when the ex-attorney general, Mr. Robert Kennedy, said that it was conceivable that in 40 years in America, we might have a Negro president. That sounded like a very emancipated statement to white people. They were not in Harlem when this statement was first heard. They did not hear the laughter and bitterness and scorn with which this statement was greeted. From the point of view of the man in the Harlem barbershop, Bobby Kennedy only got here yesterday, and now he's already on his way to the presidency. We were here for 400 years, and now he tells us that maybe in 40 years, if you are good, we may let you become president. Perhaps I can be reasoned with, but I don't know. Neither does Martin Luther King. None of us knows how to deal with people whom the white world has so long ignored, who don't believe anything the white world says, and don't believe entirely anything I or Martin say. You can't blame them. It seems to me that the city of New York has had, for example, Negroes in it for a very long time. The city of New York was able in the last 15 years to reconstruct itself, to tear down buildings and raise great new ones, and has done nothing whatever except build housing projects, mainly in the ghettos, for the Negroes. And of course, the Negroes hate it. The children can't bear it. They want to move out of the ghettos. If American pretensions were based on more honest assessments of life, it would not mean for Negroes that when someone says urban renewal, some Negroes are going to be thrown out into the streets, which is what it means now. It is a terrible thing for an entire people to surrender to the notion that 1/9 of its population is beneath them. Until that moment comes when we, the Americans, are able to accept the fact that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity, that we need each other, that I am not a ward of America, I am not an object of missionary charity, I am one of the people who built the country. Until this moment comes, there is scarcely any hope for the American dream.
Because the people who are denied participation in it,
by their very presence, they will wreck it.
And if that happens, it's a very grave moment for the West. Thank you.
You've been listening to Paul Outlaw reading James Baldwin's 1965 essay, The American Dream and the American Negro. You can find out more about Paul Outlaw at outlawplay.com. Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Michael LeBeau and Melanie Keller and produced by Brian DeShazer, who also produced this week's feature. The Bee Gees and James Baldwin himself performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Brad Furr of KGAY in Palm Springs, California, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on 2CHR Chestnut, New South Wales, KUCR Riverside, California, WREK Atlanta, Georgia, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.